Okay, testing, one, two. I just plugged this in. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Alexander, and I have the enthusiasm. Now I'm going to try to give you what I believe is an important message or several messages. First, I want you to realize that IEEE has provided you with a very, very good opportunity to learn things that you will not have learned in school. And that's nothing to say against educators. I've said a lot of things against educators, so I have a reputation about that subject too. But you have an opportunity here to ask questions of two people who have experience and who, at least one of whom, is willing to tell it as it is. And I mean, as it is. So you ask the question and you'll get the answer from me. You may not like the answer, but you'll get it. Now, there are two basic messages, really, that I've got. By the way, I've got a set of notes here, which I'll probably eventually forget where they are, and I'll be wandering all over. So this is just to get me back on track. I have two basic messages to give you today. One is interviewing concepts, whether they are done here on the campus or however you have learned to do it, are important to you throughout your whole career. There will be very few of you that will hold only one job throughout your career. And of those that do hold one job throughout their career, will probably be in a rut. Remember that. Now, you may want to be in that rut, but if you're ambitious and you want to grow and grow up towards whatever goal you have set, the chances are you'll have more than one job, so the chances are you will have to interview more than once throughout your career. Now, the other message is that some of you may have aspirations of being managers. And that's one of the changes that some engineers make throughout their career, usually at what's called the mid-career position. But be sure you want to be a manager. Be sure you understand what a manager does, because too many engineers make lousy managers. Now, however, in the process of presenting these two messages, these prime messages, I'll be bringing up ideas. I'll be throwing out things, statements that I won't complete. In other words, I won't tell you the why of things. I'll just tell you, well, here's the condition. It's up to you to ask questions later, and I'll give you time to ask questions, and if you ask them, I'll tell you what at least my opinion is, and I'll tell you whether the opinion is held by many people or just me, which is probably an impossibility for one person to hold that opinion. Now, to start off, before I get into this interviewing business, because that's going to be an easy thing to go through with slides and so forth, I want to bring to your attention what I think are your 11 most critical decisions you'll make in your life. And when I'm giving you these decisions, I'm saying that somehow they relate to your career and to your career planning. You may not see the significance, but from where I sit, as I look back, they have a meaning. Now, the first decision is that somewhere along the line, you already made a decision that an education is your most valuable asset. Either you made the decision, or your parents made it for you, or someone made it known to you that it's an asset. And I assure you, it is the most valuable asset you will possess. My mother used to say, get a good education. She came from the other side. We lived on the Lower East Side of New York, on the city streets. And I vowed that I'm going to get off those streets somehow, and I want to know what the formula is. And the formula she gave me was, get an education, for one good reason. Nobody can ever take it away from you. Now, you can waste it away. That's your privilege to do it. And Vince is going to tell you how not to waste it away. But you can get it. You can't take it away from you. My father, on the other hand, said, hard work never hurt you or hurt anybody. He preferred that I go to work instead of go to school. Well, I combined the two. I said, all right, I believe hard work will never hurt me, but I'm going to work hard to get a good education. And that's a philosophy that's held me in good stead over the years. Now, you may or may not accept that. And again, by the way, if I say things you may not accept, that's fine. It's your life. I'm trying to give you a little guidance. Now, number two decision. You ought to have a life plan. I mean, what's that got to do with it? Well, if you don't have a plan in life, you will not be able to reach your goal in a profession because you wouldn't know how the thing fits in. And so I'll drop that subject. You can pick it up later. Number three, choosing your first professional job is your next critical decision. And that's what you're doing right now. And I will be almost rash enough to say, I'll bet you that 75% of you aren't doing the right job on it. That's been my experience when I was recruiting. So choosing your first professional job is very, very important. But what you do and how you learn to do that first professional job is what will allow you to remember to do when you try to get the next job. And I'll tell you why I don't think you're doing a good job today. And you can challenge me later. There are too many jobs offered. You don't think it's that important to do a good job now because you probably got 10 offers. There'll be a time, however, like it was in 74 or back in the Depression when I graduated. In the Depression, there were zero jobs offered. In 74, there was a big layoff. That's when everybody said, gee, we got to find out how to get jobs. There'll be times again like that. So learn how to do it right. Okay. Next, this one, I guess the ladies will laugh at me on this one. By the way, I want to apologize right now to the ladies that if I use him and his and too much and I forget her, it's not because I disrespect you. It's because I'm used to doing it this way. So bear with me. But the next important critical decision is getting married. And if you don't think that's related to your job career, you're going to be sadly mistaken because if you, for instance, let me give an example. If you want to be the president of a company, you've got your goal to be a president of a big company, your wife's got to be something special to be able to take all the gaff that goes along with the politics and the comradeship or non-comradeship among women of other officers, the politics involved. She's not that kind of a person, you're not going to make it. Or you're going to get divorced. So it's important. You've got to make that. That's why you need a life plan. All right? Leaving your first professional job is another critical decision. And too many people don't know when or how to leave it. And I'll try to give you some hints later. All right? Now, when you're trying to leave it, right now I'll give you one hint. Don't ever leave a job before you have another one. I mean, it's just common sense. That too many people don't use common sense. So remember, don't ever leave a job before you have another one. And make sure that the other one is a better one. Otherwise, you're wasting motion. A resume which has too many jobs on it looks like you're a job jumper. And that's bad. That gets thrown in the basket too often. All right. Now, when you're leaving a job, there are many ways to do it. So you have to make a decision whether you're going to go for the job ads, you're going to go for the agencies or the headhunters or your friends. And by the way, as you get higher and higher in a business world, the best way to get a better job is through friends. So make some friends. And we'll get to that. Now changing, and this is probably one of the most drastic decisions you might make. You've studied as an engineer for 4 years, maybe 5 years. Somewhere along the line, some of you will make a decision, gee, engineering is not for me. So you're going to go out of engineering. That's not easy. So we'll get into that a little bit later. Then your ninth decision is to be or not to be a manager. And you better decide that over a long period of time. Study managers. See what they do. Do you like what they do? Do you like the way they do it? Would you want to do the things they have to do? Would you fire somebody, someone you like, when you have to? A lot of emotions involved, a lot of details, a lot of dog work that you guys don't like. But it's a good position for some people. Then the tenth decision will be, when you have reached your highest level, I'm reading this, of competency or incompetency. The latter is bad. But if you reached your highest level of competency and you are only 40 years old, say 45, maybe 50, you got 15 more years to go. What are you going to do? You know, you have a feeling you're not going to go any further. There's some plans you got to make for yourself. But if you reach the highest level of incompetency, then you got a problem. Because you're going to be one miserable character for the rest of the time. So try never to reach the... Don't strive to the point or for a job that you're not... That you will never be competent in. And then the final is maximizing your involuntary retirement. Let me give you an example, from personal example. As Chuck says, and I'm not bragging when I say this, I'm supposed to have been a pretty fair expert in education, college relations, training, power, the power industry, as of a year ago, April of 1978. But the company, by the way, now when I say company, remember, there is no company. It's people. It isn't the company that does you harm or doesn't promote you or does something wrong to you. It's a person or persons in that company. That's what a company is. So the particular persons that rule this particular company said that we have a policy. When you reach age 65, you're useless. So you have to retire. This was April of last year. Had I been born 6 months later, January 1st, they couldn't do this because the law says now you can work until 70. You see, I'm trying to point out here that there are little things that you have no control over that affect your career. And never forget that. You have no control over it. You've got to work around it or through it sometimes. All right, well now let's get to the interviewing business. This message is based on 40 years of, by the way, Chuck says for the last 21 years I was manager engineering manpower. That's true, but I had 20 years of experience in engineering before that. So this is based on 40 years of experience with five companies, electronics, power, and lighting companies. And also a lot of voluntary participation, and I emphasize voluntary. By God, one of the ways you can really rise up in your profession is to give a little bit of yourself to other organizations, IEEE, you name it, ASEE, whatever you're interested in, or Boy Scouts. You got to give something, you get something in return. You can never get anything out of a membership in any organization unless you put something into it. So I had a lot of professional, technical, and other industrial society committees. And usually, on any committee I joined, I became chairman. Why? Because I was willing to work. The other guys weren't. And that's the sign of that's what a chairman's there for. He's got to get the people whipped together to get something done, or do it himself. Because you know, especially if you have a conscience. Now, most people pursue careers in engineering because they are intrigued with problem solving. But much more is involved in an engineering career than being a good engineer. A fact that too many engineers discover too late. Career planning is just as important to you, ultimately, and to your ultimate success, as the education and skills you acquire and the personal characteristics you inherited. And never forget that each of your assets may be developed further through continuing education, challenging work assignments. Remember, challenging work assignments as opposed to routine work assignments. You've got to be always on guard against routine work assignments, especially if they go for a long time. Don't ever say, I don't want to do any routine work. Everybody's got to do that. But you don't have to do it for a whole year on just that one routine job. Or voluntary participation in professional societies. Now, while my principal thrust in this particular talk is on college interviewing, and you may already have had some information that way, I assure you mine will be different. Because I'm telling it to you from the industrial point of view. The concepts that I present, however, will hold you in good stead throughout your career whenever you have to change jobs. And the following career competencies are necessary. Number one, Know yourself thoroughly. You haven't got any idea what to sell unless you know yourself. And by the way, the best way to know yourself is to write your autobiography. And keep this autobiography going. But include in it the skills you think made you successful in each event or made you fail in each event. Skills, knowledge, and other characteristics. Then you see, I'm in a bookstore and I see some guy or a girl picking up a book on how to write resumes. And I says, hey, that's a waste of time. You're going to copy someone else's idea of how to write a resume, or you're going to take someone's point of view on how to write a resume? It's foolish if you don't know what to put in there. So I always point to a book, and the title will get you if you haven't seen it. What Color Is My Parachute? Have anybody seen that book in a bookstore? By Bowles? See, you haven't even done your homework yet. But I recommend $5.95. Softcover. I'm not selling this book, but I think it's a darn good book. And by the way, it was prepared under the IEEE. Maybe Vince will talk about it later. But this book, yeah, and what this book does is say, look, first thing you do is write this biography. And it makes sense, because you're collecting all of the data. First of all, after you state your problem, I want a job. I want a good job. Then you're collecting all the data. You see, it's an engineering approach. This guy did it under IEEE auspices. Anyway, know yourself. Then research occupational information well in advance. And I picked up a little career planning placement service, and it tells you that. Do it well in advance. Don't let a recruiter see you in that library or whatever you call it 5 minutes before the interview or scurrying through the book. Because I always ask the question, do you read our literature? And if I get an answer, I skim through it. I know you skim through it. I just saw you doing it. We have a hard time in that interview. But sometimes it turns out good because the fellow recovers or the girl recovers. And I like those kind of interviews when there's a little bit of change of pace. But then set yourself some flexible goals, because the practical world changes. Now, today you want to be president of a company. But after you're in a couple of jobs, oh, the hell is that? That's too much work. The kind of things I've got to go through, I'm not built that way. I made that decision 20 years ago. It's not for me. I'd rather be an achiever than a politician. And Vince will tell you, I'm not a politician. My committee, whenever I'm on the committee, all hell breaks loose. So, all right, so you may be a perfect politician. That's your job. That's your thing to do. But set flexible goals. Now, for your sake, not for God's sake, for your sake, plan your life and do a long-term planning job rather than short-term. Because you get some idea of where you want to go and what other things fit into those plans. like getting married to the right person to fit your plans. But there are others. Should I continue my education? Which way should I go? Towards a PhD or towards an MBA? You know, these are things that are important. Now, use the engineering problem-solving approach, which you've all learned it here, and always remember, and here's the point I want to put across, always remember that employment, and you're going to like this because it's an engineering statement, is a best match optimization problem. Best match optimization problem for you and the employer. He's trying to match something different than you are, but you're both trying to match in the best way. The interview is one of the most prominent parts in this matching process. Now, we now know why interviews are conducted. You see, I have a paper clip here. That means something. Okay. We now know why interviews are conducted, and if you don't, let me repeat why. For you to get the best job offer that is available, and only you are the judge in this process. Or your wife may be if you're married, but you are the judge. And for the employer to get the best person available. And hopefully, that best person, or that person, or you will be judged by an experienced engineer, not a personnel person. And I have a thing about personnel persons, but that's another story. All right, may I have this slide? Someone turn the machine on there, and if I can operate these buttons properly, I will be on my way. So now what I'm going to do is go through a very short presentation of what a campus interview is like, and from then on, you will extrapolate that some of these things are concepts that will hold you in good stead over the period of your career. An interview, as you all probably know, comprises of an interviewer, an interviewee, and a little cubicle. And that little cubicle, I don't know what you are. I understand the placement officer is in the room. I don't know what your interviewing office is like, but I've been in some horrible situations. And let me tell you what a master's degree student, an MBA student at MIT, wrote on his master's thesis about interviewing, what he wrote about that little cubicle. He or she, I've forgotten whether. I quote, "There I was in this little sterile cell, trying to sell and be sold, with the babble of a dozen other bargainers in the air. It struck me that the whole setup was some mixed up house of prostitution." And I end the quote. Now, the story here is you've got to concentrate on your interview, not on the babble that's around the room. Otherwise, you make a bad impression on the interviewer. And you will not sell yourself. Now, what's the interviewer? Well, he is the company. Whether you like him or dislike him, you don't like what he does in it, he or she is the company. He's making an impression. And it may be a good or bad impression. And you should learn from that impression. Is it a company you want to join with that kind of an impression? His judgment is respected. No matter how bad he is as an interviewer, the company back there thinks he's a pretty good, or he or she are pretty good guys. That's why they sent him there. They spent a lot of money. Or maybe he's someone that can be spared to do it. You can judge by how the person presents himself, what he talks to you about in the interview, and his appraisal is important. It's important to you and to the company. Ideally, he did his homework. Now, you say, what homework? Well, he certainly should know what jobs are available in the job. He should be able to talk lucidly about how an engineer fits into the jobs. If you have a question about some particular jobs, he should know how to answer those questions. And I'll tell you, personnel people do not. They have generalities that they present. He may, for instance, detect in you as a person, geez, we don't have a job like that. But you know, that person sounds good. He can go back and talk to a department and say, look, you don't have a quota for such a person, but this is a real find. How about let me bring him in to have him talk to you? See, a personnel person couldn't do this. So from my point of view, you have a better break if you're talking to an engineer. Make note of that. Now, what is the interviewee? Well, he or she, and by the way, see all the he's and his, my apologies still holds. He or she is seeking a job, and this is an assumption, because I've had many people come into my interviews to practice. Well, I don't care if they practice, but they should tell me in advance. And then I'll really give them a practice session, see? He is making an impression. You're damn right he's making an impression. And if you didn't do your homework, you make really some impression. So his answers are respected. Oh, we've got to, you say something, I have to believe you're right. So if you don't believe something, don't say it, because the guy will interpret it the wrong way and it may hurt you. Only say what you believe is the right thing you want to say. And he reveals himself by his resume. Oh, his resume. He reveals himself, yes, by his resume. Misspellings? I don't know. Am I recruiting at college campus or in an elementary school? That makes an impression. Questions and answers. If you don't ask any questions, or if your answers are not well thought out, it's an impression. Your personality. You come in there and slouch and say, all right, I'm here. What do you got for me? I may not have anything for you. And I'll tell you so in 2 minutes. And then the correspondence, and that's where the biggest pitfall is. Bad letters. Hell, I've received letters from people who didn't even have put an address on it or a name. Now, how am I supposed to answer this? And then I'll get a nasty letter from a placement director. I says, I don't like your company's attitude. My student wrote to you, and I don't think I care to have you on my campus the next time. That's fine. I take the letter and send it back to him. I says, would you answer it, please? And then I get in a letter of apology. See? Read the letter over several times. Communicate. I'll tell you, if Vince doesn't say it, I'm going to say it. Your biggest two assets as a successful engineer or successful anything are covered by the word communications. Learn how to write and speak as well as you can. It's an art, but that's what's going to get you the furthest. And finally, ideally, you did your homework. Not 5 minutes before the interview time, but over a period of time. Look what you can do when you read some literature about the company that isn't, things that aren't in a brochure. You come in all full of enthusiasm, and you catch the interviewer with his pants down. He says, gee, you know, I read about this, and tell me about it. And the guy may not even know. I said, what'd you learn? What'd you read about it? Well, I read in the Sweets catalog, you know, the industrial catalog. If the interviewer doesn't have to know everything, this may be an article about the company buying up a new company at that particular time, and it wasn't generally known. Well, fine, let me get the answer for you. A good interviewer will say, fine, I'll get the answer for you, you see. But you already have made a good impression on the guy. You've taken the time to find out something. And really, if all of that kind of information were made available on here's where I take a crack at the placement office. The best placement office, or what you call it, the resume or student campus interview sheet or whatever you call it on this campus that I found is at the University of Wisconsin, Jim Marks. And by the way, he's an engineer turned placement director. And his sheet, it's a back and forth, gives me everything I want to know about you quantitatively. Consequently, when I go to the campus, I spend a half an hour just talking to you as a person and learning what you want to do and things like that, which is what really the campus interview is basically for. Okay, the result of this campus interview, there's only one result. Either you get an invitation to the office for further interviews, or you get a nice note. And that's where it is. Now, what should an interview be? Well, for my money, it should be a two-way communication. I like the kind of interviews that I was able to conduct at Wisconsin. I just come in there, we sit down, we relax and say, tell me what you want to do, and then ask me any question. And I can gain a lot by just the way that the response comes from you as a person. So this, and we both can get the information we want in that period of time. I got the other quantitative stuff on the sheet. And it's really just a mutual evaluation. Do you like me? And therefore, do you think you might like the company? And if you don't, quit. Don't waste time going on an office interview. You have the privilege of saying no to an invitation. Especially now, everybody's giving you invitations. It's nice to go on an airplane. I know I was once on a flight from New York to Indianapolis, and this was a character that we had given a job offer early in the period, about November, and I see this guy coming down the plane. Mr. Dwan, he's got these two sheets to the wind on the plane already, and he says, I just came back from an interview in New England. And I says, hell, I thought you had been on an interview to New Orleans the other day. He says, as a matter of fact, I had 33 already. Well, how in the heck can you make a decision with 33 interviews? Well, if you want to take trips, fine. what the outcome has to be, a decision to simply to explore further in the office and get more information. Now, there are all kinds of guys I met, and here's one. The guy that, you know, the toughest kind of interview is to interview someone who won't tell you anything. He's got a secret, he's going to keep it to himself. Well, you don't think this fellow's making an impression? Darn tootin' he is. And then, of course, there's the guy, usually this is a PhD type, who comes in there and sits like a thinker, and his resume is full of misspellings. And, of course, his philosophy is that he is a thinker, and he doesn't have to write. Wrong. When you get into industry, you've got to make your points either by speaking well or writing well. I don't mean to pick on PhDs, Dr. Alexander, but it's natural with me. Now, here's the types of interviews you might come across. And there's a guy that sits in a room, he's asked you a question, he checks off, and he's got a whole sheet of check-off points, you know? Well, you know, that's not only boring to you, but he's not getting any information out of that system. And I think at this point, this particular guy and I were both on the campus, I think it was at Illinois Institute of Technology, we were both on interviewing engineers. And when he left in a hurry, he was, 5 o'clock, he was off, you know. I hang around, and of course students come to me after a while, and we get into real nice sessions after that. And he left his checkoff sheet there. There are 38 questions on this checkoff sheet. For crying out loud, you can't ask a question once every second, and you only have 30 minutes to do it in. So some of the questions that he had on there, and I can't, for the life of me, maybe the placement officer here might be able to rationalize this. There's one question on there, and I only picked three. How do you feel about flying commercial airlines? What the heck's that got to do with engineering? Another one. How are your grades in English? I say you got to learn how to speak and read well and write well, but what's that got to do with the point at this juncture of the interview stage? And do you have any artistic abilities? All right, I don't understand it. Maybe you do. Now then, there's the stress type of interview, which I despise. And if I had to go through it again, and anybody tried to put this on me, I'd walk out. And these are usually frustrated psychologists who have gotten into the personnel department. They tried all the theories that they learned and almost failed. It's a painful process, and I don't know why students subject themselves to it. But besides, there's some that give psychological tests. Well, what the hell is a what is a psychological test? It's just to prove whether you match the organization. Will you be a good yes man in the organization? Well, you want to be a yes man in that organization? Fine. I've never been a yes man, so I don't know how it feels. The engineer normally will search for information, and that's the right way to go about it. That's all we're trying to do. We're trying to find out the information, see if there's a mutual understanding and a match. Remember? Optimization match. And then, of course, someone who gets just called off the shelf and because they have a hole on campus X to go recruiting, he goes out there, he might use a combination of these things because he hasn't been trained. So you have all these possibilities of meeting them. People. Now, as you know, a campus interview is only 30 minutes long, and there are certain things that have to be done. The company must be described. Unfortunately, the company has to be described because you won't read the literature. We spend money. One of those brochures may cost $3 a piece. I will send it out there and you don't read it. Well, you haven't done your homework. You really ought to fail right from the beginning, but we need people, so we tolerate it. And we have to describe, so we're taking so much time out of the interview from doing other more important things. Now, the interviewee must be heard. And if the interviewer doesn't allow you to be heard, well, he's stupid. He doesn't learn a damn thing from you. So he's got to give you equal time, and I usually gave equal time to be heard, understood, and motivated. And by the way, if in that equal time, you have your chance to sell, and you should sell yourself. Now, again, don't oversell, though. I mean, I've met these kind of characters. A guy comes in and says, geez, I'm good at anything. I haven't been president of this, president of that, president of that. He's got a 2.3 IQ. I don't think he can do everything. And this guy doesn't impress me too much. There's a guy that says, well, I'm ready for anything. I can do any kind of a job right now. That's a lot of bull, too. And then there's the guy that really has learned all of these concepts that the educators have given you, but he never learned how to define a problem. And that's not what you're hired for, because nobody's going to help you define a problem, because once the problem is defined, the rest of it is more or less easy to do. The hard job is to define the problem. So don't try to give that kind of an impression. It's not going to work with the right, with a good company. It will work with some companies that don't know the difference. Now, so what happens? Well, the interviewer must do his homework. And what homework is there? Let's see. Is there a place I had another clip? Maybe I don't want to miss a point here. No. All right. What homework? Well, you've decided to work, I hope. You've determined what work you want to do. And by the way, it can change eventually, but right now you've decided what work you want to do. You've read the company literature. This is the homework you should have been doing. You've prepared an informative resume. And this, by the way, is the thing that you should always remember. You're going to have to prepare resumes throughout your career. So learn how to do it right. And by the way, as you progress in your career, there are different forms of resumes that make a better impression for that particular level of work that you're seeking. If you're seeking a job as a president of a company, you're not going to send them your college form. There's other things, other ways to present your data. So that's where the books on how to write resumes may come important. But just to give you the forms that are used, remember that you got to have the substance to put in. And by all means, learn how to write and do practice interviews somewhere, and learn how to speak. Okay, now let's see. I think we're getting near the end here. Now, during the interview, a student should, above all, listen. That's the process that most people neglect. Good managers listen before they speak. You should listen to find out what it is that the company man is trying to sell to you, and then he should listen to what you're selling to him. Relax. Don't go in there and get so tensed up. And the guy across the way isn't there to hurt you. He's there to try to hire you, provided you got the goods that he's trying to hire. So make it, enjoy it. Tell it straight. Acting doesn't help one darn bit. A good interviewer can detect an actor and answer the questions that are asked. For instance, now this is something that, very often in my interviews, I have one pet question that I ask. If I can find it here. Now, the question that I ask is this, and I'm trying to find some of the answers that I had. If you had the ability to get any job you wanted, any place with any employer, what would you want to do as an engineer for the first 4 years? And I try to remember some of the things that... I'll get an answer like this. Why 4 years? Now, that's a question. That isn't an answer. I ask the question, I expect an answer. I'll tell you why. Well, you spent 4 years preparing yourself to be an engineer. I should think that you'd want to at least spend some time working as an engineer, and I arbitrarily say you want to spend 4 years. And after that, if you want to be a manager or a baseball player or a veterinarian or whatever, well, that's your business. But give it a whirl. See if you like it. And I'll get an answer, you mean for AEP, which is the company I work for? I didn't say AEP, I said any company. He wasn't listening. See, he's making an impression. And things like this go right along, and pretty soon I said, well, this guy is maybe not for us. Well, now, I was getting back, I was going to go back to this. Here's a statement, and this is a God's truthful statement that appears on a college campus form that I received last year. And it's under the part that says, describe the work you desire. Now, here's the guy's statement. I prefer my employment, I quote, I prefer my employment to be a composition of and balanced by a reasonable salary, a responsible position, opportunity to advance in position and salary in a reasonable time with sufficient ceilings and an environment, paren, positions and locations, congenial with my personality and preference. Now, what the hell does that mean? It means the guy's off his rocker. And then a little further on, he again said, under the statement says, location preference. He says, quote, anywhere, especially where well-compensated, unique areas. But we're not anywhere. We're in a certain location. Why did you come to interview us? All right. Ask questions and leave on a friendly note. Now, what does an interviewer look for? Well, there are only a few things he looks for. What makes you tick? That's exactly what that interview process, so I'd rather talk to you over a half-hour period and find out what makes you tick. What do you want? What have you got to offer? And what can you do? And what are you going to do for the company for what it's going to pay you? Now, these are the answers you ought to have, because that's the way people are hired. And what should the interviewee expect? Well, certainly courteous, fair, mature treatment. If I promise you that you'll get an answer within 2 weeks, you should expect an answer within 2 weeks. And any company that doesn't give you an answer within 2 weeks, you should perhaps write them off. Especially in this job market you have today. Don't do it when jobs are hard to get. But it's a sign of the company if they don't give you that courteous, fair treatment. You should get straight answers, not around the bush type of thing, so you don't know whether you're coming or going. You should have been given a chance to speak during that interview. You should get an objective appraisal, and I venture to say that you can't get an objective appraisal from a personnel person, because all he can check is your personality, your dress, where you're on time, did you slur your words, and so forth. That's not what we're really on the campus for. We want to know whether you're going to be a good engineer. That's what we're going to hire you for. And then you should get prompt feedback. And if that's my mistake, and here's a summary of what I've said, and I hope there's time now to answer questions, but I have a few more points that I want to make which will help you as you go beyond the campus interview. Learn to speak, learn to write. I've said it a lot of times, I'm going to continue to say, and I hope Vince says it about a half a dozen times. These are the two most important assets that you're going to have. Do your homework, be sure you want to work, know what you want to do, and sell from strength. Don't sell from weakness. You can only sell from strength if you know yourself. What are your strengths? All right. So that is a story, I believe. Yes, and let me leave that slide on there while I, if I can get it back there. Nice to push buttons here. Let me now just conclude by saying, give you some thoughts for your long-term objectives. Number one, each company has a different ball game and different ball game rules. So when you join the company, learn those rules as fast as you can. Otherwise, you're going to be swimming upstream. Two, the players in each ball game have different skills. They have different methods, different ethics. Be sure you fit into that ball game. It's pretty hard for you to find out what that ball game is from the outside, but it can be done by somehow contacting the right people, associating with some younger engineers. That's where you get the real story. Don't call a guy, you know, that's my age. Get the guy that just joined the company. He'll tell you what the ballgame rules are and ballgame is. And while you're on an interview, while you may have a set schedule in the office, ask permission to talk to some of the young engineers. That'll throw them. And you'll find out some things you may not know otherwise. Number three, keeping fit maintains your ability to stay competitive, but keeping fit is not all in your own control. You know, there are other things that affect your career, and I told you some of them. Now, each person has a chance to become obsolete in his own way and time, and vice versa. So choose your destiny wisely. Therefore, in each job change, establish a good match. That's the most important thing. Establish a good match. Acquire thorough knowledge of your job. Implement with enthusiasm. Whenever you're working for a company, don't slouch off. Even though you already decided, this is not for me, I'm going to quit after I find this new job. Give it all. When you're leaving, you got your consciences on your side. You felt that you've been ethical, you've been professional. The company can't say a darn thing about you because you've given all you had. And they have to give you a good response for any inquiries later. But give it all. And give more than may be expected of you so that your conscience is clear. Now, maximize your career. And here are the ways, three ways you can do it. Continuing education over a lifetime. That's all I'm going to say. Develop your oral and written communications skills. Appraise yourself periodically. In fact, it would be better if you did it continuously. Be nice if you had someone else do it for you, too. And then maximize your whole self by being professional and ethical. Volunteer some of yourself, your skills, your knowledge, and your other assets to your profession. Give a little bit of yourself to the profession, the community, the family, your friends, other persons. My parting word is, be a balanced person. I said it correctly, didn't I? Be a balanced person. It's written, be a balanced man. Be a balanced person, and you'll get your success. Thank you very much. What I just said is I haven't got time for some questions. That's for the paper clerk. Yes?
At the beginning of your talk, you made a remark about never getting into a job for which you'll never be competent. How do you know in advance?
Well, you don't. You don't know in advance. What I thought I said was that as you're rising in your profession, don't strive for a job where your background will not get you to be competent there. Now, the only way you can tell that is by observing the people in jobs like that and judging for yourself, are you like them or are you not like them? What's their background? And saying, are they doing a good job? Can I do it better? And if you should be able to answer that honestly. For instance, many years ago, I decided that I did not want to be a president of a company. Or, for that matter, an executive vice president, or a vice president, perhaps. See? And there's one good reason. My personality would not allow me to be a politician. And that's a prerequisite of being that particular kind of person. So why strive for it? I'll only be incompetent in the position.
Yeah, it's more like planning. And you said a bit about planning. And how can someone...
And what are you doing? Are you on an assignment to a specific project? Are you on an orientation program? Are you on a formalized training program? These are the things you should have looked into when you were interviewing before you took that job, because you get different outputs from that particular period, and it's very important. For instance, you're joining a company. You don't know whether you're going to stay in that company more than a year, and I told you stay at least 1 year. Don't ever quit a company in less than a year, because you are not doing justice for yourself nor to the company, and you become known as an unprofessional. But in that first year, you should get the most out of it. And one of the things you should get out of it is whatever education program or skill program they have to offer. Take it. What do you got to lose? Take advantage of any benefits that will help you grow as a person. During that first year, make sure that your jobs are challenging. Now, some of them will be routine jobs. Not all routine jobs are unimportant. Let me tell you an experience with AEP. After I had already 3 years experience in the engineering field, I designed electric motors for Diehl Manufacturing Company for almost 2 years and designed lighting systems and equipment, prismatic equipment with halophane. So I already was an experienced engineer, and I thought I was pretty damn good. And I finally got a job with AEP. You know what my first job was? Cleaning out the files of a particular section into which I was hired. Now you say, my God, you must have been out of your cotton picking head to take a job like that. Well, in the first place, I didn't know I was going to be given that as my first assignment. You see? But you can either take a bad attitude or a good attitude about it. And I'm going to spend this a bit of time and leave some of the other stuff out, because I think it's important to give you a point. Now, in that job, what the boss said to me, look, we've had these files here for 40 years. We don't know what the heck is in them, and we haven't got enough space. We can't buy new files. Clean them out. I said, well, what should I throw out? I said, that's what we hired you for your judgment. All right, now here, I'm in a power business. This is the first time I'm in the power business, you know, in this particular field. And they're telling me to throw out things that they were dealing with for 40 years. Okay, I asked people, well, what do you think I should throw out? And they said, don't bother me, I got work to do. And by the way, that's going to be your first job. Don't bother me, I got work to do. See? Well, don't be inactive, God. That's for one thing. Don't sit there twiddling your thumbs. Do something. I can tell you lots of stories about doing something, but let's get on with this one. So I went to business. All right, they want me to clean out the file, I'll clean out the file. So I went, and there's a whole row of them. There are about 40 files to go through, you know, four-tier files. And so I said, no, wait a minute. If I just throw this stuff out because the papers crumpled up or something, I'm really wasting time. I'll read the letters. I mean, they're paying me, so I might as well read them. So I read the letters. I learned the history of that company. I knew that Mr. Sporn, who was the then chief electrical engineer, was going to be the president of that company someday because he was running everything. And I particularly paid attention to his letters because he was setting policy. And his letters I kept, the others I began to throw out. All right? The blueprints I began to throw, I kept piling them up because, you know, I didn't really know what's important, what isn't important. There were blueprints of power plants. And during the first week, now here's an experience. I'm sitting there in this sort of a library type of thing. There are about 10 engineers on what they call, rotating chairs, is it? They're waiting to see the chief engineer, Philip Sporn, who was the one-man show, period. And they had to get all their stuff filtered through him, and he made the decisions. And the bell rang, the phone rang. Oh, I said, I'm here 3 days. Why should I ring answer the phone? I don't know what to say to the guy on the other end. The bell rang. And here these 10 guys have been in the company 20 years, wouldn't answer the phone either. But the phone was annoying Mr. Sporn. He came out to me and he says, do you work for this company? Yes, sir. How long do you want to work for this company? I hoped it was a permanent job. Well, then answer the phone. God's honest truth. So he doesn't know how many phones I answered for the next 3 months. Every time it rang, I'd make sure someone was, all right. So I learned something. But go on with the story. After I had three piles of blueprints about that high, which I didn't know what to do, the other stuff I kept throwing out, I asked my boss, who said, well, look, these blueprints, I really don't know what to do. I said, chuck them out. We can always make new prints down below. All right, so we threw it out. That was an easy job, see? Now, the point of this story, after I got through 3 months of this, routine, deadening, I almost quit after the second week. But I said, no, I tried to get this job for 3 years. I better stick it out, at least 3 years. What was the situation at that point? I was the only guy who knew what was in the files and where they were. I was the expert. And that's the God's honest truth. These guys that were in the company for 20 years had to come to me and, where's this? I said, well, I threw that out. You threw it out. So you can actually make yourself very important by doing a little thing. Okay. Well, now, next point was, I said, if you, the first year, you really find yourself doing a routine job, you know, that you just despise, check other people, other young people who have been there at least 5 years, young people, don't go to the old guys, go to the young guys, and see what they're doing, get their point of view, and if you see that, you got to be sure that you're going to be doing some of that same stuff. You're no different. If you don't like what you see, that's the time to look for another job and then quit. Okay, now, some other point here that I want to make. Where is it? Right here. These points are good before I get into the other part. When you first join the job, you're the low man on a totem pole. And you better be aware of that. And there's nothing wrong in saying to yourself, I admit it, I'm the low man on a totem pole. That's a good position to be, because nobody in the company can be jealous of you. They know damn well you can't do anything to take their job away. So the first 5 weeks, I'd say, maybe 6 weeks, everybody's your friend. That's the time to ask questions. Really, you know, sincere questions. You can learn a lot in that five-week time because nobody is afraid of you. People are human. After that time, when you begin to start doing work, that's when the people problems start. They become jealous, they become threatened, they think you're their competition, you probably are their competition. After that, it's a different story. You've got to be careful whom you ask, what you say. But that first five-week period is a lovely time to get information and take advantage of it. All right, so now you've been in a company between, say, 7 and 10 years, depending upon what industry you're in, and you've got the opportunity, or you have been made a manager. And now if we may have the lights. Let's see, I guess we need the projector. You've been made a manager. Now many studies have shown. Okay. Many studies have shown that engineers often are chosen for management positions simply because they were outstanding engineers. And that's about the most useless way to pick a manager. Because the ability and qualities which made them outstanding engineers will not necessarily make them outstanding managers. Consequently, some engineers become good managers, and many others do not. Now let's start out with a hypothesis, three hypotheses. We can say that all engineers, because of their particular education, can be good in all management jobs. I can tell you from experience, and you can read for yourself in many writings, that the probability of that occurring is very, very low. And we can also say that some engineers can be good in some management jobs. Now, this is a very high probability point. And then we can say that engineers generally make good managers, and here it's a matter of opinion. My opinion is that's a crock of bull. And there are some people that will say that I'm wrong. Now, in order to explore this subject, let's start out with the management definition. The classical definition of management is that it is the art of determining, planning, directing, controlling, and measuring the use and effectiveness of both human and physical resources. Now you can already say that if the job is 50-50, that the engineer in general has only a 50% chance of being successful in doing this job, simply because of his education. All right. Now, management methods over the years have changed. Back in the prior to 1900, it was the autocratic type of manager. You do as I say, or you're fired. Well, that doesn't hold true anymore. You've got unions and you've got other protective agencies, so you can't really manage that way, or you certainly won't keep the good people that way. Then there came this so-called scientific management era, where they measured jobs and tried to make people do things more effectively, more efficiently, and it got that term scientific. It wasn't very scientific. It was more of getting more out of a human being than maybe he should be putting in that particular time. And actually, from that led the problem of the fact that people were doing minutiae, and they were becoming, well, the auto industry is an example of it. From the 30s to the 50s, because of this condition that preceded it, they began to talk about human-related management. Then we went on after the war to pressure-type management, because we had to get things done in a hurry because of the time lost during the war. And now, more or less, people talk about goals and results, although I see new books appearing which are called gamesmanship, and that's more like politics. That's management by politics. And I even read a book on management by obstruction. And there's more truth to that than poetry. So we go on. Now, this is a slide that I apologize for. IEEE has redone the slide. By the way, the other slides are mine that were done by AEP, but they never sent me a copy. So levels of management are the administration level. This is the top level, and some people think that executive level is the top level. The classical definition, the administrative people are the ones that create policies and then administer the policies, and someone else executes them. So they make broad planning, policies, measurement, direction, and leadership of the whole broad organization. And the executive level, they carry out the plans, policies, and decisions. And then as the staff, they advise in special fields. Now, the staff is the area where engineers make excellent managers, and where a lot of them get into that particular area, because they really still continue to be experts in the areas in which they choose to be experts. They begin to fail in the executive level, as you'll see, because they could care less about human aspects of the problem. They don't like human problems. They like the physical problems. And only those that are astute politicians get up into the other area, and most engineers are not astute politicians. At least you know one that isn't. Now, so we now come to the next condition and say, well, what makes production? And that's what industry is all about, production. Well, it's industrial practices and management practices in combination make production. Industrial practices are setting goals, planning, research and development, and engineering. You can see now this is the area in which an engineer should shine, and he does. So if he is in these areas, either as an engineer or as a supervisor or as the next level person in management, he probably can make out well in this area. However, in a management practices, it's setting broad objectives. You know, like we want to be a company that will manufacture nuclear vessels, but keep everybody on our side. All right. Well, you see, that expands now over all kinds of people, and the problem is a people-oriented problem, political-oriented problem, so forth. And you got organizing the business, motivating, communicating, where engineers don't come out very well. Measuring results. This is measuring results not only of the business financially, but also of people results. And you'll be amazed how badly engineering managers appraise people. They don't like to appraise people. They want to make everybody's good. I mean, in my section, there's no doubt about it. We're doing a good job. So they don't rank order people at all. And that's where problems occur. And develop, and they don't want to recognize, give recognition to outstanding work. Developing people, again, another area, and deciding. And unfortunately, I found a lot of engineering managers that have a hell of a time making decisions. Why? Because they want to have all the facts. And you can't have all the facts when you're under a time constraint. You've got to make a decision with half-baked facts, maybe. Or less than the kind of facts you need, you think you need. You got to take a chance. It's a risk thing. Okay. Now, I like this. Many years ago, I think it was in a Business Week, this managerial grid was shown, and I thought it was superb. On the ordinate axis, we have the concern for people. And on the abscissa, we have the concern for production. And you can already feel that the engineer would be concerned for production. That's really his field of activity. And I've been telling you that the concern for people is kind of bad among most engineers. Not all, but most. So a 1-1 guy is the guy this fellow over here was talking about. You know, he now has gotten to that highest level of incompetency or competency, whichever you feel. He doesn't want to go any further. He likes his job. He's neither too concerned about people. He probably is a lousy manager, and people are quitting on him, but nobody takes the job, the time to find out why. He really doesn't have that good a production, but he takes the abuse from his boss, and he doesn't mind. See? So that's the guy that will not get any further. Of course, it's the 9-9 guy that has concern for people and has good production. And these are the rare birds. And there are some rare birds, I'll tell you. They are good engineers at the top positions in many companies. But they have somehow acquired the concern for people and the concern for production. The guy that upsets me is the 5-5 guy. He's the organization man, the yes man. He'll swing with the top management, whichever way it goes. He's really the obstructionist in this whole business. And you can visualize the other two. Actually, the 1-9 guy is the guy who should be head of personnel. He's very concerned for people, not so much concerned for production. And actually, my experience is that's not what he is, what that personnel guy is. The personnel guy normally is the guy that can deal with unions, with labor relations, and keep the salaries down. And that's what I've been fighting for my career here. Okay, now what's an engineer's work? Well, an engineer's job is to do whatever tasks he has, and he brings to that job knowledge, experience, skills, and some people interactions. For instance, those of you who are officers in clubs on a campus, which is a very, very valuable experience. You now know a little bit how to deal with people. They're your friends. Eventually, you're going to have to deal with some of the enemies, too. So this is a people interaction problem. So you might have some of that. But actually, your knowledge is technical knowledge. And that's limited to that. So you're mostly dealing with technical in some specific field. Electronics, power, communications, whatever. And only a branch of that power. And you produce a work output. Now, where does your work come from? Well, it's either from yourself, and that's what I said in that first 5 weeks or first year. Don't sit idle. Make work. You know, during the war, when I was with the Office of Science and Research Development, I was put into a company, I'm not going to mention the name, and they didn't have no work for me. I mean, we were in the war, and I was anxious to do my part. And so I went around, I said, what the hell do you need done here? He says, well, I found all kinds of things. And one thing that struck me is that they needed one of these cages, the high frequency, what do you call it, the cages? Pardon me? Faraday, yeah, the Faraday cages, so that your high frequency wouldn't spill over into other laboratories and cause problems. I said, well, haven't you got it? Well, we put in a requisition 6 months ago, and it's got to go through X number of signatures, and they got to make drawings, and they've got to get the labor department to do it. I said, well, I'm not doing anything. Why don't I make up the drawings? Oh, you can't do that. It'd be against company policy. So I made the drawings anyway. I came in one day and I was so in need. We were working for a Navy on a special project and we had to get these results. And I finally convinced not the supervisor who was out of town, but his assistant. Hey, you better sign this thing. Let's get the material ordered. I had it all specified. And it came in. And over the weekend, I came in on Sunday and I built it. And it was clear. Everything was there. And, you know, here's this big cage. It was by 12 by 12, I think, or something, cube. And it began working. And it began, then reports began coming out. And the boss kept saying, he got upset with it. He said, you're going to get in trouble and all that. But the bosses above him began to say, gee, that's good. You're finally getting on these jobs with productions. Wonderful, wonderful. Then it came the inspection. It came down the laboratory. Let's get this. And all hell broke loose. That was my first demerit in that company. But anyway, so you do it. I mean, it's worthwhile. Do it. All right. Oh, I'm sorry. Now, what I was saying is the work comes from yourself or from your boss. And your feedback is really from yourself or the boss and only very few other people. Okay. Now, what is the manager's job? Well, you see, the manager's job now is very much more broader, very much broader, and it is more complicated. First of all, he gets his work from his boss, or he may have several bosses, from the internal group, you're giving him jobs and problems. Outside groups are giving him problems because you have to interact with outside groups, and himself, if he's a good boss. All right, now he has certain knowledge. It's got to be much more than just the technical knowledge. Otherwise, he can't be a good manager, and so forth and so on. You can read the slide as well as I can. But now the feedback to him is himself, his own group, outside groups, and his own boss. And you see, the job is very much more complicated than just a technical job. So what? Somewhere along the line, if you want to be a manager, you've got to make this transition. You notice I've got a gap up there. You'll always do some engineering. You always have to be at least on some fringe of engineering if you're in a technical area. But you should gradually relinquish your engineering and gradually pick up the management job. If you don't, you're going to be an empire builder and you're not going to be able to build very long because you're not going to be able to handle all the work. And somebody's finally going to catch up with you. But anyway, you're not going to do your job right if you don't pick up the management area. All right, now again, this is a new slide. So what kind of things do you have to pick up? Well, you have to pick up new tools. And there, now, look carefully here. You guys, I've heard it 100 million times from young people. I don't like to do dog work. See? You're going to have to do some dog work, whether you like it or not. But if you don't think a manager's job is dog work, you've got a second guess coming. You got to pick up new things, policy manuals. You got to read stupid things that the personnel department have prepared. And you got to implement them. And some of it is inconsistent. And you're continually in a hassle. You've got job analyses and evaluations. In other words, you got to write a position description. You have to read it. You've got to make it conform to what you think is right. Then you got to evaluate the person on that. This is not engineering. You know, there are a lot of factors that you can't quantify. And so forth. Down the line, every one of these things deal with people. That's where the engineer fails. Most engineers fail. Because their education, in the first place, has not made it known to them that that's an important factor in industry. Now you got certain management skills that you have to deal with. Now you got to lead. You can't be led anymore, you see. And incidentally, if you ever get a chance to read a good article. It's in a Harvard Business Review. I think it's probably the year 1974, in that era. It's called How to Get the Monkey Off Your Back. And it's a good article to tell you how you become a good manager. For instance, the best type of manager, they list what they call orders of initiative. There are 5 orders of initiative. And the highest order is the guy who does something and then gets clobbered later if the boss don't like it. See, you've shown the initiative. You are the guy that's doing it. Now, you've got to know when to use that, because if the company basic rules prevent you from doing that, then don't do it, because by God, you're now stupid. You're not obeying what the company rules say you should. But you have an alternative. You go to the fourth order of initiative. And in that order, you say, you recommend that certain things be done. Now, you see, you've shown the skill of being a good manager, and you put the monkey on your boss's back. He's got to hear them and make a decision. And do it in writing. So he can't deny it. Well, then there are the orders, and if they're funny as they go down. But anyway, now you have management skills, and leadership is one important thing. And this is one of the things you can learn in college by being a leader in your IEEE, or your Eta Kappa Nu, or Tau Beta Pi, or whatever. This is where, look, this is the case where you can practice management without getting clobbered, because you're among friends. Why practice it out there where everybody's trying to cut your throat? So anyway, human relations is a very important manpower considerations, person power considerations, coaching. Very few managers coach properly. Very few managers will delegate. And that's stupid, because the more you can delegate, the more time you have to think about other things, the more you get other hands working for you and so forth. And you got the rest of them there. Again, things that engineers don't like to do. All right? And this is the big crux right here. If you're a manager, is it easy for you or difficult for you to handle people problems? This is the crux of it. In other words, the company lost money. You have a section. You were told to cut 10% of your people. How are you going to feel about it? Who are you going to cut? It's an emotional problem. You've got to be equipped to handle it. Direct or misdirect? I tell you, a lot of people misdirect. And by the way, one of the management forms of management decision, and remember this because it's important, is no decision. No decision is a decision. If the guy doesn't answer you, doesn't want to make a decision, he's telling you something. So you have just X number of times that you can pursue it before he blows his top or you blow your cool. So these things, but that doesn't mean you have to stop. You have to find suitable ways to get around that. Do you cultivate or stifle a person? You better cultivate, otherwise you're going to have one big problem area to direct. Do you strengthen or discourage? I've had only two people in my lifetime out of nine managers, big men, who encouraged. In my last job, which was the manager of engineering manpower, it was created in an era when engineering education was going down the drain, and I'm going to give a chance for the educators to ask questions. During the Grinter Report, they started the scientific math orientation of engineering, which is not engineering at all, and things progressed, and the power industry began to lose its part in the program. They threw out power courses. The power industry couldn't get people for other reasons also. So the president got upset. He said, "Diary, do something." That was my order. Do something. And then I had to create the job to do something. Well, ever since that time, nobody cared less what I did. And as soon as I found out that, then I began to do everything in the area in which I felt that I could help the company and help the industry, and that's how I became so pervasive in my activities. I could have also sat back on whatever you sit back on and did nothing and probably got the same kind of raises. I got very few recognitions inside the company. I have a lot of recognitions outside the company. So you have to take that as with a grain of salt. As long as Vince said it, if you're happy in your job, do it. And that's what I mean. That's what I was doing. So, and then do you expel confidence in your people or fear? And it better be the former. Well, oh yeah. Now this is the slide that we created, and IEEE did reproduce it, but didn't send me a copy. So let me see if I can read it. No. What I was going to say here is I don't have it, unfortunately. What I was going to say here is the engineering education does not fit itself into preparing you for the kinds of things that I have just described. And I don't recall the ECPD percentages, but it's something like 25% math and science and 25% engineering sciences and so forth. We can get the correct figures later. But humanities are down around 12%, and usually what you study in humanities are the easy courses, so you can get rid of them and not anything beneficial. So you're really not getting the humanities portion that you need for the job. If you want to be a manager, take an MBA course after you decide that manager. So that's what that was appearing there. Now, the profile of a typical engineer, he's strongly work-oriented. He's serious-minded and conscientious. See what, this is all saying nice things about you people. Precise, meticulous, perfectionistic. He possesses high energy level, which is needed in management. All of these are needed in management, provided they're directed in the right places. Satisfaction in a production work, and stick-to-itiveness. And that last one is really the thing that I want to push, because quitting, if you think you got a good idea, don't quit. Keep plugging at it and going around each barn, each fence until you get it done. And there are lots of ways to get things done. Now, typical interests of engineers, and these are from research studies. This isn't just what I cooked up. There are five or six intensive studies that were made by Deitch and Shea and many other consulting firms. They like technical literature. An engineer avoids social aspects, and there should have been political aspects of business, but I guess that's included. They have little interest in the humanities, and they avoid people problems. Absolutely avoid people problems. And that's where their downfall is in management. So now, here are listed the good qualities of engineers, and what I want to do, and this was done by Walter Given, who was president, he's an engineer who was president of American Brake Shoe Company, and in an article which he called Upside Down Management, or Management from Below. He was a believer in getting feedback up from below and then making decisions. He listed, and others have listed, these qualities of good engineers. And then proceeded to ask, are these particular qualities necessarily good qualities for managers? And let me now just read these few of these, because I want to get it the way it was stated accurately. Let's take structural visualization. Is that one of them? Yes, that's the first one. This attribute refers to understanding spatial relations, ability to think in three dimensions. I'm now building a brick wall on my acre of land down south there. And, the quality of spatial relations is just working fine for me, because I can look down on a pile of rocks and say, gee, this is going to fit into that space there, get the mortar, and I throw it in there. And it fits sometimes. My wife, how did you figure that out? See? Well, she doesn't have that ability. She has other abilities. All right. Let's see. I lost my place here. Yeah, three dimensions. Handling forms and shapes. Engineering schools tend to weed out those who are lacking in this quality and develop it in those who do possess it. This attribute may be a useful quality as a special knowledge for some managers. Or you can visualize that in a production field, this kind of, especially when you're fitting machines into spaces and trying to get an effective way of handling a machine process, that certainly is a good quality to have. But it necessarily would not be in other areas. Imagination. This attribute is characterized by an unfettered mind and thrives on freedom to roam in search of new ideas. If projected into executive work, it must be harnessed carefully, for it can become a liability in dealing with subordinates. The engineer may want to push his own ideas harder than those offered by others. However, it definitely is a worthy asset for a manager. Judgment. This quality requires an adequate command of the facts, reasoning power, and the capacity to exclude bias, emotions, and temperament patterns. This attribute may help a manager get the physical job done, but it is poor training for judging people. Ability to communicate. This quality is too frequently missing among engineers and often distinguishes the good ones. The engineer should be able to communicate his thinking in a clear, concise, and orderly manner. Other professional persons with whom he works, accountants, lawyers, so forth, are not always interested in cumbersome details. This quality is a very, very useful special ability for a manager. And one more, analytical power. The ability is to follow cause and effect relationships and to break down problems into their simpler and more manageable components is vitally important in engineering as in other fields. This quality for a manager is especially useful, but it often leads an engineer to overlook the human actions are assigned in the form of responsibility to secure results. The individual can best develop a feeling of belonging, of being a part of the organization. And then when they have accomplished their assignments to your satisfaction and to the satisfaction of those to whom you are responsible, see to it. See to it. Insist that they receive the recognition that they deserve. A pat on the back sometimes is a hell of a lot more than a 5% raise, especially if it comes from the right guy. Recognition too often is the missing link in management. And I think I'll skip some part here because we're just almost 5 o'clock here. And let me give you this parting thought because I happen to like it, and you'll bear with me. It comes from Charles Proteus Steinmetz, and I quote, "If I were to bequeath one virtue to every young man or woman, I would give him the spirit of divine discontent, for without it, the world would stand still. The man hard to satisfy, the man or woman hard to satisfy, moves forward. The man or woman satisfied with what he or she has done moves backward." End of quote. You should also note, however, that the former man or woman is the harder person to manage. Thank you very much. Well, I've kept you to 5 o'clock, and I know you have other things to do. If you have questions, I'll be glad to answer them later or now. But feel free to leave if you want to.
How many here want to be 2 minutes?
That's about the right percentage.
Any questions? Yeah, Dan?
I think you should first get a good engineering education because that is what you want to do initially. You can't be a manager right away anyway. And I would say that a good engineering education is one step beyond your BS degree. It certainly is a master's degree in electrical engineering. However, once you decide that management will be your ultimate desire, go for an MBA degree. Now, you could either do that at night if you were at the right company. That's why it's good to choose the right company. Ask these questions. They may send you to MIT for nothing. Pay all your salary and expenses and so forth. Or you can get it at night, or you can take a leave of absence. But if that's what you want, you better get the MBA. or a legal degree. Now, I should have said that. A lot of engineers have gotten legal degrees and have become very top high up in the organization in management.
Any additional questions? Thank you very much for your time. Larry will be around for 2 minutes, so let's go on to the next part. And the next session, Mike, this will be legal today with Howard Hamilton, Jack Kent, and Bill Farrell. And they'll be speaking on IEEE legislative activity, on pensions and benefits. Like I mentioned before, pensions and benefits might be the least important thing on your mind right now. It's going to work for in 9 years. Investing money in a retirement system, having to invest money in a retirement system, they lay you off. You find out that you have nothing in the way of benefits for retirement. So you walk away from that job, there's nothing to show for it. It's very interesting. And it happens. Come on and find out what it's all about. See you next week.
Well, we're going to